Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Every year, the San Francisco International Film Festival brings together talented filmmakers and conservationists to showcase the beauty of our oceans and highlight their vital role in fostering a healthy and thriving planet. And this year, the International Ocean Film Festival will be back with more than 30 spectacular films encapsulating the beauty of our oceans and how we can protect, restore, and celebrate them for generations to come. The 22nd annual International Ocean Film Festival will take place from April 11th to 13th at the Cowell Theater in the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture in San Francisco. And today we are so pleased to be highlighting two very compelling documentaries that will be featured at the festival. Later in the program, we're going to discuss Saving Seagrass, a very powerful short film that underscores the vital role seagrass plays in the ecosystems of Mobile Bay, Alabama. But first, we're going to talk about an important issue that hits very close to home. Salmon Run is a documentary offering an in-depth look at the salmon fishery here in the San Francisco Bay Area and outside the Golden Gate in the ocean waters just off our shore. The film introduces us to the dedicated men, women, and organizations that are working tirelessly to preserve and sustain this vital industry here in California. And we're so thrilled to be joined by the film's producer and director, Peter Cruitt. Peter, welcome to Your Call's One Planet series.
Thank you so much.
Now, I want to congratulate you on the film and let listeners know that Salmon Run is now streaming on Apple TV and Google Play. So if you haven't already seen it and you want to see it after this interview, that's where you'll be able to watch it as well, of course, at the film festival. So, Peter, it's wonderful to have you on. Congratulations on this really beautiful and eye-opening film. There's a lot to discuss in your film. It tees off a lot of issues. But first, let me ask you, why did you decide to focus on Bay Area salmon fishing?
Well, I'm a fisherman, sport fisherman myself, and I do know many people in the fleet personally. Many people in the documentary itself, I fish with them on their boats. On their charter boats, and they in decline, and I had a feeling that the world need to know about their situation.
And Peter, for people who are not familiar with salmon fishing in San Francisco, how critical is the industry for the city and for the Bay Area as a whole? What role does it play in our economy and in our culture here?
Oh, it does play an amazing role because the fishery is based on our restaurants. A fisherman's wharf is depending on it. Then you have, of course, the charter boats. You have the people who fix our boats. It's a whole web that's all related to this fishery. On top of that, fishermen come from all over the world to catch a salmon. Those fishermen are not coming, so the hotel business is affected. So it's a whole strain of different industries that are affected. And most importantly, the commercial and the sport fishery, those have families themselves, and they are just on the shore standing still because the season looks like it's going to be closed this year for the third year in a row.
So yeah, I would definitely want to ask you about the current state of the fishery and the prospect for salmon fishing here in the Bay Area. One of the wonderful aspects of this film is just your sort of in-depth, almost character studies of these fishermen and fisherwomen, people who are drawn to do this for their livelihood. Can you talk about some of the examples, stories you tell in the film and how this is really a multi-generational type of enterprise? I was really struck by how many of the people who do this for a living were introduced to fishing because of their parents, their grandparents, or if not fishing itself, just some aspect of processing fish here in San Francisco.
Yeah, so one of the main characters, Paul Capuros, his family came from Sicily and were in the old days running the wharf. And when I say wharf, we talk about Fisherman's Wharf here in San Francisco. For example, his family, there's nobody left on the wharf. Paul is the only restaurant. It's called Capuros. I highly recommend to eat there. But unfortunately, he's the only one left out of that family. What we also wanted to show in the movie is the establishment, like Chris, who's a commercial fisherman since he was a child, and he definitely saw all the changes but I also wanted to give the fresh perspective, like Wes with Wild West Sport Fishing. And he's a young captain. He's like 22 and he's starting his business. So there will always be more business coming and going, but at the moment it's getting into decline and closing seasons is not helping the industry at all.
Well, I do want to talk to you about the latest on the fishing industry, but I wanted to get a sense of the history of this industry too, because you interview people who talk about how there really was a heyday of salmon fishing and fishing in general in the Bay Area in the 50s and the 60s. Can you talk about the sort of origin of the industry and leading up to the present state today?
Yeah, so when you go back to the origin of the early days of fishing, we had sailboats. They were catching the salmons with sailboats. Sailboats would come from the open ocean in, and then the fishery was always kind of, the fleet was not big enough to sustain the fishery itself. But now we have this whole foreign boats that came in the 50s and 60s, and they were scooping up basically all the salmon overnight with their big nets. And I think that's really what started hurting the local fishery, because our fleet was, when you catch a salmon just with a hook, what we only allowed to here in the Bay Area, those fishermen, they don't take a whole school out. But if foreign boats come to the Bay Area with massive boats and these big scooping nets, I think that hurt our industry pretty well, very bad. And that's why now our fishery is so much hurting, because the salmon itself, the reports they're getting now into the hatchery programs, there's just not enough returning fish coming to hatch.
And we're speaking with Peter Cruitt, who is the producer and director of the new documentary film Salmon Run, which is screening at the 22nd Annual International Ocean Film Festival in Fort Mason in San Francisco, April 11th to 13th. And Peter, it was really shocking to hear about these foreign boats coming in and potentially depleting these fishing stocks, as you and others in your film have just described. Can you explain a little bit about the legality of that, and is that still happening, that foreign boats can come in and harvest these resources?
Well, that's of course kind of a mystery. The word is that it doesn't happen, but we see it. It's a global issue, right? It's almost like pirate fishing, right? Those boats can come and go into our waters, and is there really a system in place yet to check on that? I personally don't think so. I hope it doesn't happen. I know having the season pretty sure this year closed for the third time is a sign that there is not enough fish in the ocean at the moment. And again, to go back to when our conversation started, the local fishery is hurting because of that. And it's for a lot of people their livelihood.
Well, let's talk about that. So what is the latest now with the salmon, the stocks of salmon, the latest on fishing, and what's led to this situation today?
So, you know, it's of course, we can talk deeply into the global warming, and I think that has a lot to do with it. And very important now with 40 million people in California, also our water rights. The fish in the old days didn't have to deal with that. And because of human, we have 80% loss of habitat because of damming and our agriculture. So what we try to show in this movie as well is that if we do lose those water rights through global warming and through agriculture, what could we approve? And in our opinion, that is the hatchery programs. And through a better hatchery program and better release, what's happening now with what we show in the movie with pens. When I say pen, it's a huge bassin that we actually have in the ocean that we don't need the waterways. We can directly bring those young fish straight to our oceans and release them instead of getting them through our waterways. And I think that's a really big future. And it's really happening. The hatcheries are in close contact with our fishermen and women, And I think those programs will get us more fish in the ocean eventually.
It was really stunning to hear in the film one of the people you interview say that essentially there is no wild salmon left in California. They're all pretty much tied to these hatcheries, and the hatcheries did seem to be really the only option to try to deal with all the things you just described, the dams, climate change, the fact that we do need the water for agriculture in California, and that there's less water that people are fighting over, these different industries are fighting over. So a lot of the film is dedicated and really a fascinating insight into how the hatchery program works. Can you describe how hatcheries work, where they're located, and what that job looks like for people working in those facilities?
Yeah, so the hatchery programs is also in direct with the loss of habitat of the salmon. So by law, where we did create dams like Coleman Dam, there was a hatchery program put in place right after the dam was built. The programs of the hatcheries, are the people that work there are amazing. You know, they devote their whole life. They come when and salmon is on the end of his life circle. They collect the fish. They make sure that the eggs are coming together with the males, the sperm, and it's a whole operation. If anybody that's listening is in California, go out there on their open days. They have you can free enter and see what the operation is about. And I think it's the future. The management, I think there is still a lot to learn. But what I said before, they are now in communication with the fishery. They are start working closer. And I think that's really where the future is. And also what Chris, one of the main characters in the documentary, talks about. I also think to school programs, to create smaller hatcheries. I think anywhere where a salmon finds his way upriver and there is not enough water anymore in the future, I think that's where we need to get a closer program so that we don't count on the five main big hatcheries that's around mainly Sacramento area. So
we're speaking with Peter Cruitt, the producer and director of Salmon Run, a documentary with an in-depth look at the salmon fishery in the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond the Golden Gate. It's going to be screening at the 22nd Annual International Ocean Film Festival, April 11th to 13th at Fort Mason in San Francisco. This is Ethan Elkind hosting Your Calls One Planet series today. I do want to open the phone lines. If you enjoy wild-caught salmon and are worried about the future of the salmon fishery here in the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond, are you a fisherman yourself and have thoughts about what you're seeing out on the water? Are you involved in the fish industry at all? Maybe perhaps at these hatcheries. Have you visited a hatchery? Have you eaten at the restaurants in San Francisco that process the salmon? We would love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email with any questions or comments or reflections or memories that you have about salmon fishing to yourcall@kalw.org. And Peter, can you talk about where these hatcheries are located and how they are essentially breeding this fish and then getting them back into the ecosystem?
So the McCollum Hatchery is by Lodi. Do I pronounce that right?
Yes, Lodi.
Yeah. And then what I said, then we have the Coleman, it's an hour past by Sacramento. What is kind of remarkable that the fish bring it up that far. And then we located it Nibis, and that's in the Sacramento area itself. And that's the three hatcheries that we filmed. There is a hatchery in Big Sur, but unfortunately that burned down with the wildfires a couple of years ago. But I have been told that they are rebuilding it.
And it would be interesting, yes, Peter, it'd be interesting to hear a bit more for listeners who aren't that familiar with the salmon life cycle. Where are they coming from and where in California are they going to? Can you talk about the spawning behavior of salmon? It's so fascinating. They're a really remarkable species.
Yeah, it is remarkable because we have it from Washington into Oregon, then of course California, but we also have the whole string, of course, in Alaska, that's super famous for their wild salmon. But sometimes those wild salmon from Alaska are coming into our riverways. And what is so unique about the lifespan of a salmon, it's one of the few fish that actually is born in the river, then find itself through the mainly, for example, snow melt into our ocean systems, where they grow to full length, and in a lifespan between 3 and 7 years, remarkably, they just come back to that same river, and then that's where they spawn, and they get to the end of their life circle. And hatchery program 4 years ago released a big part of the salmon into the Santa Cruz Harbor. Those fish came back to the harbor, realized that was not their birthplace, still from the harbor of Santa Cruz, found it back to McCollum Hatchery. And all this we know because 25% of the fish get a nose clip with so that they can track them through their life journey. And those fish were tracked in the harbor and later back into the hatchery.
Well, it's just amazing how they are able to know where to go, how they go back to where they were originally hatched, and in some cases, colonizing some new areas as these fish are coming in from the water. So it's really a fascinating life cycle. And can you talk about Chinook salmon? Are these all Chinook salmon? What species of salmon are we talking about, or varieties of salmon, and a bit about the history of those fish?
And then we have the silver.
But okay, Chinook because, and silver.
Yeah, but the silver, that's an issue for our sport fishery and the commercial. We're not allowed to keep them because they are protected. And it's not so much that you think like, okay, there comes the group of kings and there comes the group of silver. Of course, they mangle, right? So sometimes when you catch them, you have to release them. I disagree with that because the fish is already in your net and it's the scales are already damaged. So either if we throw them back, they might be hardly alive. And 4 years ago, at once we had a whole school of Spanish mackerel mixing with the king salmon. So last year when I was fishing actually with Wes from Wild West Sport Fishing, we saw a mile long school of king and silver in the bay by Farallon Islands. So they are there. The only thing is at the moment why the fishery is closed, we don't see enough coming back into the rivers to spawn.
And I understand that Chinook salmon have been declining really going back to the mid-1800s when we started building the dams that you referenced earlier and hard levees and, of course, now climate change, invasive species. How are Chinook salmon faring now?
Well, what we saw last year in the oceans, they are there. But we had a lot of rain in 22, so the numbers should be good this year. But as I said before, it is a lifespan of 3, but sometimes 5 to 7 years. So if you have 22 and you add the 7 years, there might be still a huge group of salmon out there that didn't make it back to the rivers. So I do have high hopes. Also, what I said before, with the better programs, how the hatchery is now working with local fishery, but it's still not enough to sustain a whole industry. Like how we started the interview. I mean, so many different aspects in the Bay Area, so many different companies need to live of it. And let's say the sport fishing by itself maybe would be okay, but I don't think at this point with the numbers we are seeing that there is enough for a commercial fleet. So,
and we have an email in, but Greg from El Cerrito asks, when and how does the state decide to ban or limit salmon fishing? So can you talk, Peter, just about that process?
Yes, so involved at the state? In the movie, thank you for that question. John from the New Rian, he's in a commission, and basically it all goes by the counts that the hatchery are getting. And so when they see the decline, how many fish are making it back to the hatcheries, that's where they decide, okay, we don't have enough numbers, so we don't have enough release. and then that's the decision to close the season.
So is that sort of a last minute decision? I mean, are they sort of seeing real time?
It's all. I think this year we are close to getting the final yes or no, and because normally the season around this time will open, but I'm pretty sure that the rumors are that it's not going to open at all. But sometimes you also have to understand, like last year, McCollum Hatchery donated 7 million eggs to Coleman because they had no fish in front of their gate, and out of nowhere from the Delta, this whole big group of salmon showed up at the hatchery at Coleman out of nowhere, and then they had too many eggs. So you have to understand with the hatchery, it's a whole process to make it from the eggs into a smolt. There's a small salmon. And then to release, you can imagine it's a lot of work for them. So if they don't have the numbers, they don't feel comfortable to open the season.
Well, and it feels like such a fragile industry. I mean, what's happening to the actual people working in these industries when all of a sudden they're told that salmon fishing is completely ruled out? Are we seeing people leaving the state? What's been the impact, and how is the workforce essentially managing in this kind of uncertainty?
Yeah, I do fish with one gentleman out of Alameda, and he actually relocated last year in Georgia. And there's a small little ocean there, and he has six kids, and it was Ross is his name. It was not doable for him. And there are, that some retire, but I'm pretty sure once the season will open, our fleet will be way smaller than that was before the closing. I have to say that there is reimbursement money, but of course that's just like a drip on a hot plate, because it's not what they normally would catch. A $1 billion industry, and then I think there was like, let me see quick.
Yeah,
23 million was promised to the local fishermen, but so far, three seasons almost in, I do know from Chris that he still did not get his first reimbursement check delivered.
Yeah, so challenging. So challenging to think about how these people are managing this kind of uncertainty, really in some ways at the front lines of our ecosystem collapse and climate change. And I know that the big solution here is to try to expand the hatcheries, but who's paying for the hatcheries? What are the barriers to getting more hatcheries deployed and up and running?
Well, so the McCollum is also the company that has the water rights for Oakland. It's their ground, so they are supported by the state and that particular water company. I know Coleman is federal, so that's federal money. So I also think what we talked about before, as much that we can count on California and state, we also should get smaller programs like the fishery in Half Moon Bay that we show in our documentary. Those literally are local Half Moon Bay fishermen that have a net pen themselves. And that whole program is by volunteers, and it's phenomenal. And McCollum Hatchery goes directly to those fishermen. And it's all volunteering and donated money. And I think that's where in the future we all can make an impact if we all, put a fist together in California.
And if you're just joining us, I'm Ethan Elkind, and you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. We're speaking with Peter Cruitt, the producer and director of the documentary Salmon Run, that talks about the salmon fishery in the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond the Golden Gate. Salmon Run is up and streaming on Apple TV and Google Play. It's part of the films featured at the 22nd Annual International Ocean Film Festival. Is taking place from April 11th to 13th at the Cowell Theater in Fort Mason in San Francisco. So much to talk about, Peter. I also want to talk to you about water policies. That is just looming so large here. There's limited water, especially with climate change happening in the state. One of the people you interview talks about how we've really lost a lot of our snowpack storage, and the dams that we built are not equipped to capture all the runoff that's coming out of the Sierra Nevada when it used to be essentially held onto, stored as snow and released more slowly. Can you talk about the water fights here in the state and how agriculture is essentially pitted against these industries like salmon fisheries and those who care about habitat and ecosystems for that ever dwindling supply of water, fresh water in the state?
Yeah, it's, I think California, like we did have one almond farmer that wanted to talk to us about the movie because I was very clear that I was on the salmon fishery side, but she gave us an amazing knowledge about even the industry itself. As an almond farmer, it's hard even for a farmer now to get water, and they in the state now have to buy water. So when the farmers already have to buy water for one another, you know, there's not much water left for the salmon industry, and it's, and the fishery itself doesn't can make a fist as big as the agriculture, and not even talking about wine and all the other fruits that we are growing in California. So as John says in my documentary, and I agree with him, the water rights might be a hard one that the fishery itself can win, but then getting a better program in through hatcheries and what I explained before to get actually those young smolt fish around our water systems and then bring them to the bay and release them that way, I think there is a big future there. I did talk to John last year, what's not in the documentary, and they are in communication with the agriculture itself, and we all trying to get up to solutions, but I was not myself in that conversation, but I do know that there has been talk between the fishery and the agriculture in California.
I also want to remind listeners that we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions about the future of the salmon industry, if you've gone out on these salmon boats, if you enjoy eating salmon, if you have thoughts about what should be done, the number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email in any questions or comments you have at yourcall@kalw.org. And Peter, what might be some of the fixes for the water fights here in California? One of your farmers that you interview has really taken steps to have more water efficient agricultural practices. Are there solutions on the agricultural side or solutions potentially on the fishery side that could help resolve some of these conflicts over water?
Well, that's of course, you know, a million dollar question, because water is getting scarce. And me personally, I would hope that once we have those massive storms coming through California, that that water doesn't run straight into our oceans. But where were you going to create other like reservoirs, and how is that possible? I'm a filmmaker, so I couldn't answer that question right away. But I do believe that with this, the rain getting scarce, we should collect that water, and you know, especially in a city. I'm here in San Francisco. Once it pours, it will go straight into our sewage and it disappears. So that would be an option. As well, I know that it's not in my documentary, but I know David's. They are doing a whole new program to raise young salmon in the rice fields, so that they flood those fields and then the young juvenile eat from there and then they get released. It's a program it's been going on for a couple of years. So I think us humans, we always will come up with some solutions, but the water itself, I think, is going to be, especially also what's happening now politically, it's going to be very hard because there's just not enough water in California to sustain 40 million people, when you ask me.
And Peter, what's being done on the ecosystem side to try to heal the ecosystem so that we don't have to rely so much on the hatcheries?
Yeah, that's I think a very hard one, because the hatchery, without the hatchery programs, what we talk about in the movie, I'm pretty sure with the 80% loss of habitat, we would have a salmon here and there going up to our water stream, but I think there would not be any salmon industry left if we didn't have our hatchery programs.
I would note that we have seen some efforts at dam removal. The Klamath, for example, is going to have some dam removal. So what's the future for that?
Yeah, the minute the dam was removed, the second day there were salmon swimming up that river. And of course, all those projects are amazing, but that's of course not to bring the whole system back to where it was before we moved in, as you know, as Californians. And then as well, like, we still have so many people living in this state. So, but anything that the programs that we talk about as well in our documentary, there is some habitat restoration. They spending a lot of money on our rivers where they spawn to get sideways, all human made. McCollamy just, or Nibbus hatchery just got a whole new ladder system, so it's easier for the fish to come to the hatchery. So there are a lot of programs in place. But again, I still think that we need a larger hatchery program for survival. And at the moment, the five hatcheries that produce all our smolts and bring it to the bay is not enough. We just need, in my opinion, to double the program to become successful.
And let's talk a little bit about what happens when people catch the fish. First of all, when is the season to catch the fish? And then how do the fish get from the boats to restaurants and consumers in places like the San Francisco Bay Area?
So we, in the film, we there's a pier here in San Francisco. It's called Pier 45, where there's a lot of the commercial fishing boats come there. Then the fish is offloaded there and goes to all the supermarkets locally and restaurants. When you talk to the sport fishery, there is a big fleet in Sausalito, Emeryville, all the way up to Berkeley, and then a fleet in Half Moon Bay that I personally fish on. You are allowed to keep two salmons, two kings, at least that was up till before it was closed. And the boat will clean that for you. And then you actually basically bring them home and you can eat them. And I seal my fish myself. And then around in Petaluma, there is D'Angelo's. He's a smoking business. And so some of the fishermen bring the fish straight to the smoker. So there's a lot of options with that fish. And most importantly, because you, as a sport fisherman, you catch that fish maybe at 1 o'clock. And at 5 o'clock, it can be in your frying pan. And I think you cannot find any fresher fish than just to go out there for yourself. If anybody's listening that ever want to catch a king salmon, I would highly to recommend to, when it's open again, to jump on one of our sport fishing outfits in the Bay Area.
Well, that certainly sounds wonderful. Peter, we're just about out of time. But my last question for you, it's been clear from the film and from your comments today that more hatcheries is the solution that you would like to see, and it sounds like others in the fishery industry as well. What can listeners do to help support that solution specifically? How do you recommend that they get involved?
Yeah, I think just start for the Golden State Salmon Association. They are in the movie. They do amazing good work. They have all kinds of different lawsuits against the state because salmon is protected. You cannot never wipe off a species of the planet. So go to Golden State Salmon Association, support them, look to their website, and they can guide you to a lot of organizations that you can support. Also, I want to say we are on Amazon Prime. Unfortunately, we were the opening film for the International Ocean Film Festival, and the film was showed this last Saturday in San Rafael as the opening film. So at the moment, they will not show my movie anymore, but at the festival, but I hope that people find time to find it online. As you said, Amazon Prime, Apple TV, and Google Play.
Absolutely. We definitely want listeners to check that out. It's already screened. So I did misstate that, but it's already screened at the 22nd Annual International Ocean Film Festival.
Yeah,
but as Peter just said,
Saturday. Yes.
But streaming now on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, Google Play. Congratulations on the film Salmon Run. Peter Cruitt, producer and director, thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls One Planet series.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to discuss another documentary from the Ocean Film Festival, International Ocean Film Festival, called Saving Seagrass. So stay with us. We'll be back shortly after this break. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information on our website at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, we love to get your ideas. You can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or go ahead and call us. We're at 866-798-8255. Now we're going to turn to another documentary that will be featured in this year's International Ocean Film Festival, the short film Saving Seagrass, which is a powerful look at the crucial role seagrass plays in the ecosystems of Mobile Bay, Alabama. And I want to welcome filmmaker and director of Saving Seagrass, Robert Boyd, to the show. Robert, good to have you with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And I also want to let listeners know Saving Seagrass will be screened on Sunday, April 13th at 4 p.m. at the Cowell Theater in Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture in San Francisco. And Robert, your documentary zooms in on the importance of seagrass. It really brings us right into that underwater nursery in the estuaries of Alabama, and you focus specifically on Mobile Bay. Now, for listeners who are not familiar with that area, can you talk about what seagrass is and why it's so important for the marine species in that part of the country?
Yeah, so basically seagrass is aquatic vegetation. It's kind of like the grass you have on your lawn, except it's underwater. Sometimes there are species that can be marine and then others are freshwater. We were really focusing on the marine seagrass in the ocean. And the reason it's important is because a lot of the seafood we eat kind of grows up in the seagrass. It's a type of nursery. You can think of it as a kindergarten or preschool for fish and the crabs and the other invertebrates that we like to put on our plates.
Well, some great visuals, just seeing these, what looks like being very vulnerable creatures, just sort of taking refuge there in that seagrass. And one of the people you interview recalls how he once caught softshell crabs, but with the loss of seagrass in that area, which once protected those crabs, now there has been nothing to protect them. So can you talk about the impact of the vegetation loss, the loss of the seagrass on softshell crabs and other seafood species in that area?
Yes, it's very sad because of a variety of factors, many of them man-made. The seagrass numbers in the Mobile, Alabama region have gone down significantly. And once you lose that grass cover, there's not really as much of a place for these young juvenile animals to grow up. So as the seagrass numbers go down, their numbers go down. It's harder to fish for these creatures. The environment itself degrades. He actually, that particular interviewee, fantastic interview, he showed me out back to his dock, and all along the shoreline, it was brown, muddy water. The seagrass actually used to trap the silt and kept the bay from being so turbid. But with the seagrass gone, it was muddy and there wasn't as much wildlife to see.
Well, and so what's causing the loss of the seagrass?
Yeah, so from what I understand through these interviews, it's a couple of factors. One of the major impacts would be dredging and development upriver. With a lot of the development of houses and you could say industrial centers, it runs off. The dirt from those construction projects runs off into the bay because it's not properly being captured on site. And it sort of acts like a giant blanket that smothers any seagrass that happens to try to grow in the area.
And what is the impact just on the local economy? I mean, this is a pretty big industry here in terms of the commercial seafood species that are harvested in that area. So what's the impact then on those local fishermen and the people who take advantage of that resource?
You know, that's a good question. I can't say for sure because I don't have the data in front of me, but I would surmise that they're having a harder time getting the same number, the same level of catches that they got in the past when that wildlife was more bountiful. You could surmise that they were making more money because they were catching more. Now they might have to go farther out. They might have to go to different regions, and that just means less money in their bank accounts.
And is there an outcry from people? I mean, I know the people you interviewed are very focused on this issue, but is this something that's fairly widely known, or do you see efforts like your film here as being able to help educate people, even in Mobile Bay, about what's going on in their ecosystem?
Yeah, so I'm definitely happy that this film is educating more people. I would say that traditionally, people have been more focused on, say, coral reefs or kelp forests. Seagrass has been largely overlooked. It kind of like people probably saw it as just underwater ditch grass, but it's much more important. And I'm happy to see that not only my film, but several other films have been coming out recently that emphasize the importance of seagrass. So I see a bigger outcry happening more recently, which is positive.
Yeah, it's definitely positive to hear that. And I am really appreciative that your documentary is raising this issue. We're speaking with Robert Boyd, filmmaker and director of Saving Seagrass, which will be screened on Sunday, April 13th at 4 p.m. at the Cowell Theater at the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture in San Francisco as part of the 22nd Annual International Ocean Film Festival. I'm Ethan Elkind, and you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series, and I want to open the phone lines. Do you have questions about seagrass? Have you been to Mobile Bay, Alabama, or have you been to other parts of the country, the Gulf Coast, that are reliant on seagrass? Do you have thoughts about what should be done to help preserve this vital ecosystem and the role that seagrass plays in supporting it? The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. And Robert, you talked about how a lot of the decline in the seagrass is due to the development and the runoff. So what's being done to try to mitigate this problem? You have some pretty striking visuals of the problem in your documentary, the silty, muddy brown runoff. But what's being done in response?
Yeah, so I'm happy to say that there are several organizations that I was working with during the creation of this film that are doing a lot of work to try to raise awareness and lobby for greater protection for the seagrass. So one of the key groups down in Mobile is Mobile Bay Keepers, and they work on a variety of subjects dealing with the health of the bay, one of them being seagrass. And they've just been lobbying for, I'd say, political protection for the ecosystem, and then raising awareness so people can be more cognizant of some of the steps they can take, like using less fertilizer and some other steps to help mitigate what's happening to the seagrass in their own area. Another organization I was actually working a lot with, this is actually how I came to the film, was with Alabama Rivers Alliance. So the way I created this film was through the Southern Exposure Film Fellowship, and they tasked me with highlighting the seagrass ecosystem and some of the issues that were occurring there. And I can say with confidence that Alabama Rivers Alliance is working very hard along with Mobile Bay Keeper to highlight this problem and push for change, I would say.
Well, there are some really interesting methods that some of the groups you were focused on highlighting were putting in place to try to address the loss of seagrass. In particular, talking about the propeller scars. This was really kind of unfortunate to see that these propellers, boats going through the seagrass, are leaving these long scars. Talk about some of the low-tech methods that people are using to try to restore those scar areas.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating methods they were using to restore those scar areas from the propellers literally cutting through the seagrass ecosystem was actually installing these bird stakes along the propeller scar areas. And what happens is the birds, you know, they're flying around all day fishing, and once you fill your belly, you have to use the bathroom. So they land on these stakes, and the droppings actually drop into the water, and it adds a fertilization to the area. Not too much, because then that would cause an algal bloom, but just enough to supercharge the grass to regrow in that area. So that was a really good way, a really low-tech but efficient way to try to heal these propeller scars. The only issue being that there's always more people boating and there's always more propellers cutting through the area.
And Robert, what's being done in terms of the policy response to this problem? It seems like this is an area where we would potentially need the state of Alabama or maybe the federal government? Who needs to step in here, and what's being done now to try to restore these ecosystems and preserve the seagrass?
Well, while I was down in Mobile, I know that the Nature Conservancy and a variety of other organizations were actually working on planting seagrass in the region. And I would assume that that had some political buy-in in order to get the permits and everything to make that happen. And I would just hope that this film leads to even greater efforts, even more political support, because it really seems like an apolitical issue. Everyone likes a strong economy and seafood and a beautiful environment. So it seems like something that any politician could, it's an easy win. You could rally around it and support it.
It seems like it, but at the same time, I know the housing development industry can be politically powerful, and it seems like some of the changes needs to be about how these developers are mitigating the runoff, how they're doing the development, the land use policies in Alabama. Is there any policy traction there or enforcement of existing laws to make sure that we don't have this runoff problem?
You know, that is a very good question. I am not sure, but I'm hoping that this film can be a tool to kind of push for greater, I would say, better behavior, you might say, because there are some steps that these housing developments can take to mitigate the issue and make it sort of a non-issue. I believe they probably have the resources to do it, and I think if they got on board with that, that would be an easy win for them.
Well, it was certainly a striking moment in the film where one of the activists, if you will, or people working on this, she was trying to look up the QR codes at these housing developments to try to get more information about how they were mitigating the impacts. And the QR code is just taking them right to the developer's website and not to the enforcement and mitigation documents that were advertised on that poster at the housing development. So clearly more needs to be done, it seems to me, just from watching your film here. What about the role of climate change here? How is that factoring in into the decline of seagrass, or is it factoring in?
You know, that is a good question. I'm trying to remember back to my interviews to pull up that specific information. You could argue that because the water's warming, you're getting more algal blooms, and that might be blocking out some of the sunlight that the seagrass needs. I would need to get back to you on that. But there are a variety of factors, and climate change is one of them. I would say that another issue is the amount of turbidity that's being kicked up by all these hurricanes coming in, just bringing the silt and kind of smothering the seagrass. That's another issue.
Well, certainly the intensity of the hurricanes has been increasing, and many climate scientists are linking that to the higher temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico there. Were any of the people that you interviewed, did they talk about climate change? Did they talk about just the things that they've seen, you know, beyond the seagrass itself, but just changes to the environment more broadly?
I will say they were far more focused on the runoff, but generally they did note the degradation of the environment outside of a few key areas. And they didn't seem very happy about it, because it's you're basically going from a bountiful ecosystem and land when you're young to when you're older and you have grandchildren, just showing them sort of a semi-barren or struggling underwater wasteland. And nobody wants to see that, I would hope.
Yeah. And talk about the restoration projects. Have they been able to bring them back? You talked about the propeller scars, but are there successes that you want to highlight?
Yeah, I would definitely say one of the areas I was filming in had great success. It, for some reason, it's a far more resilient area. One of the only places where the seagrass numbers aren't dropping precipitously. And essentially what they were doing is they were moving seagrass from one island to another region of the bay, because that island, if I remember correctly, was going to be remediated or partially expanded. So their work there has been very, very successful from what I've seen. We had a drone operator who was actually doing aerial shots, and you could just see the massive expanse of seagrass that was growing there. And I can only imagine what it would be like if you could see similar scenes throughout the Mobile Bay region, which would be a dream.
Yeah, well, just to bring back that thriving ecosystem that once was there and could be again. Wonderful that you're holding up these success stories. Just about out of time, Robert, but wanted to ask you, for people who are watching it and want to get involved, want to be able to help contribute to the effort to save the seagrass and the ecosystems that depend on it, what do you recommend?
Yeah, so what I would recommend is definitely looking into the Mobile Bay Keepers and Alabama Rivers Alliance. Those two organizations are heavily involved in the restoration and preservation of the aquatic ecosystems in Alabama. Going with those two, you will not go wrong. Supporting them, donating, and seeing what activities they're doing to push for change and greater protection of the seagrass is what I'd recommend.
Wonderful. And for listeners who want to see Saving Seagrass, it will be screened again Sunday, April 13th, 4 p.m. at the Cowell Theater, Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture in San Francisco. Robert Boyd, filmmaker and director of Saving Seagrass, thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls One Planet series.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk to you.
And I hope listeners will get a chance to go check out the 22nd Annual International Ocean Film Festival, April 11th to 13th at Fort Mason. That's our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can listen to our past shows up there and find out what's coming up next, all on our website at yourcallradio.org. Then you can follow us on social media. Email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@klw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.